This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is one of the creative forces behind some of the more innovative TV shows of the past 25 years. James Brooks is a writer and executive producer whose credits include The Mary Tyler Moore Show and its spin-offs Rhoda and Lou Grant, Taxi, The Tracey Ullman Show, The Simpsons, and the new animated comedy The Critic. He also wrote and directed the films Terms of Endearment and Broadcast News. His new movie, I'll Do Anything, opens this Friday. It's a comedy about the movie business. Nick Nolte plays a character actor who isn't considered sexy enough to get leading man roles. He's having a hard time making ends meet, and to make matters worse, his ex-wife, played by Tracey Ullman, has just informed him that he's about to assume full-time custody of their 6-year-old daughter. Now he needs a part desperately. He gets an audition with a self-absorbed producer, played by Albert Brooks, who churns out formula films. In this scene, Brooks is supposed to be interviewing Nolte for a part in a new movie, but Brooks spends the whole meeting making speeches about his philosophy of filmmaking.
You know, there are all different ways. Do you know Bertolucci never reads actors? Just looks at them, feels around a little bit, and then he decides. Doesn't read a word. Well, I also have a way. I like to interview first, then I like to read, maybe come back the next day, do it all over again. I'll call people up the actor's worked with, I'll check him out. If he's famous, I'll do an opinion survey to see if people like him. If he's not famous, I'll put him on tape, grab anybody I can find and show him the tape. That's the way I like to do it. I believe in screen tests. I believe in cutting people out if the dailies are bad. I believe in replacing people if the previews aren't there, because I don't make movies for theaters that serve cappuccino in the lobby. I make popcorn movies.
It's possible that in the original version of the film, Albert Brooks ended his spiel by breaking out into song. James Brooks made I'll Do Anything as a musical, but the songs flopped at test screenings, so Brooks deleted the songs and reworked the film.
If I had a list of my ambitions for the picture, I think, you know, the top of the list would that it be real and that it be funny. I don't know what's more important to me than those two things. And I thought the music would somehow, because it dealt with a 6-year-old child and dealt with Hollywood, make it more real, let it become a little deeper, and it had the exact opposite effect. And I've had things like this happen before, and I think, you know, practically everybody has. Usually what post-production is about is going in front of an audience and finding your picture, finding the picture that wants to happen. I mean, in Broadcast News, I lost a subplot that I really loved. In Terms of Endearment, a scene that I was particularly proud of because I thought I'd found a way to really look into where we were going with medical health, and I thought it was, like, bizarre and funny and true. I mean, those are two things that I lost in those previous films. Nothing is dramatic like this, never changed form the way this one has. I don't think any picture ever has. But it was on that same road, so it wasn't that wild to me. What was wild this time is that it became public, and I was forced to talk about it at this, you know, early first draft stage. That was rough.
Yeah. Why was that such a bad thing for you?
Because to do your work, you want privacy. It's like anybody. There's a certain kind of work you do where you need privacy, where you need to close the door. And this time when I went to close the door, there were like 9 feet sticking in it.
Well, how much do you trust screening audiences? And do you trust them over your own intuition about a scene?
No. You're doing a picture to communicate, and you're doing these screenings to get a communication. First of all, you absolutely trust whether they're laughing or not laughing. There's no mistake about that. You always, anybody who's been to these will tell you when you sit down, you suddenly gain objectivity by virtue of just sitting there with them. Before you hear anything or read anything, you're looking at your film differently. The thing that you couldn't possibly cut a day or so, you're tearing out on the drive home from the screening. This always happens. The thing you can't get from them is what they want, and the thing you can't get from them is, if you do this, I'll be happy. I mean, if you try and do that, you're crazy. Also, you can't get anything from the raw numbers, I think. You get something, you get an analytical book about how this figures it with the norm, and that's your testing score. But you have to get, if you read 400 cards from strangers who have seen your movie, what usually happens is you see a theme. It's like I always think if you're doing research, the third time you hear something, you begin to think you found something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you just, in Broadcast News, there was about the third time I heard somebody talk about a woman under a lot of work pressure, the third woman who said she cries in the course of the day pretty frequently, I knew that it had to be in the picture. When you do this kind of research, sometimes a theme will come up. You find out what they're thinking. You're reading these cards, but you're really having this unusual conversation with people about your work. And it's valuable.
But let me ask you, do you think that I'll Do Anything really should have been a musical? Do you miss the songs? Do you like the original film that you had?
Yeah, I do. I do. But I'm convinced that it worked against what I wanted to do in an audience situation. I think people watching it alone can take the leap. Sure, I liked it. I've never seen anything like it in my life. It was very unusual. And it still had the script that I cared so much about. But this is the movie that should have been made, the one that's coming out now. You know, it was a strange route to take, but this is the movie that I think is the best movie.
James Brooks is my guest. His new movie is I'll Do Anything. I have this thing about some movies that when when a woman is supposed to be not glamorous, what you have to do is like cast a glamorous star and just not have her wear as much makeup, and that only beautiful women are allowed to be unattractive in most films. And Nick Nolte plays someone who's supposed to not be sexy enough to get leading man roles, but of course Nick Nolte has actually played leading man roles in real life.
Of course, Nick Nolte spent a lot of time not being able to get those leading man roles.
Was that true? Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
I read that People magazine voted him the sexiest man of the year or something. Yeah, it was kind of ironic.
This whole adventure is filled with ironies. Nick was picked sexiest man of the year as we were discussing whether he could do the part, because I had the same reservations you did, and he kept on telling me, believe me, I know what my inner life is. I never experienced myself as this. And then this People magazine cover happened. He sent me the cover with his teeth blacked out and a mustache on him and a scar up painted on him. But the conversation he had with me was a man who was truly awkward and embarrassed of being on that cover in that way. And that conversation was as close as I've heard Nick come to, at that time, to the character that he had to play.
Mm-hmm. James Brooks, in addition to your movies, which include the new film I'll Do Anything, Terms of Endearment, Broadcast News, you're responsible for some, you know, fantastic TV shows. You co-created Mary Tyler Moore and Rhoda, Taxi, The Simpsons, now The Critic. Where do you think you have more freedom, on television or film?
Television taught me freedom. I mean, if you have a half-hour show that, you know, when we did the Mary Tyler Moore show, I came in one day, and my partner's on the phone. We picked it up with the guy who was then a CBS vice president of programming, sort of key vice president. And he was having us go through the script saying, why would anybody laugh at that? Why would you think that's funny? You know, the kind of test that no comedy can pass.
Mm-hmm.
One individual saying, I don't think that's funny. And then we got ratings. And then we never heard from him again. We never had to clear a story again. We never had to talk about a script again. We had to please ourselves. And television is great training in creative freedom, because if you have a show that works within the framework of good taste, you have total, and the time restraints, you have total creative freedom. And it's a good lesson to learn.
Whereas in film, you're starting from scratch each time, right?
Bosses, the stakes are bigger. Sometimes you have to go through committee, you know. But if a guy comes from television, you know, you have to feel the freedom to know you want it and to know what to do with it. And some very talented people, it takes them too long to be able to feel the freedom and know it's there, know what that air, you know, smells like.
Do writers have more power? Or are writers considered more important on television?
Yes. No question, by 1,000,000%.
Why is this?
Because if a series works, the thing it starts to do is devour material. Television devours material, so the writer becomes really important. And also in multiple camera television, you know, there isn't as much variety in how you can make it look. I mean, you can be innovative, you can still direct it very well, but there are real limitations. So it tends to be about the script.
Mm-hmm. Well, just in time for the reviews of your new film, you've launched a new comedy, an animated comedy on TV about a bad film critic who hosts a movie review
show.
Who
says he's bad?
Well, why did you want to do a comedy about a critic?
This took a long route, and it was a lot of serendipity, I think. It started out as a regular show that was going to be about the makeup woman on a Good Morning America-type television show, and there was going to be a movie critic in it. And then we started to focus on the movie critic, and then I saw a friend's film, League of Their Own, and I saw John Lovitz in it and went crazy. And then we wanted to do it about the critic, and then he got so many movie jobs he couldn't do a series, so we decided to make it animated. That's the whole story.
Oh, that's why it was animated, because Lovitz wasn't available?
Yeah, but as it turned out, it all meets together because it's animated, we can do takeoffs on movies which are impossible in any other form.
When you first started to do The Simpsons, was there a lot of resistance to an animated series?
Yes. Yes, enormous. And we fought really hard. And first they said, we'll let you try it as a special, and we refused, and we wanted to commit to a series. And it took a long time, and eventually they committed to a series. And then it was, you know, it was particularly tense because when we got back the first show, it looked awful. And when you do animation, you record it, you write it, you record it, and then you wait 6 months to see your film because that's how long the animation takes. So here it is. We've been doing shows all along, and the first one came back, and it was awful. And we were shell-shocked. And we didn't know whether it was the group that had worked on that particular show or whether there was something in the mix. Because there were, if you go off-model, that's what they call it when you draw the characters slightly different.
Mm-hmm.
And The Simpsons looked grotesque because there was just fractions of differences in the way they were drawn. And we had to wait for 1 week before we saw the next show and knew whether it was all over or not. And the next show was The Simpsons as we know it now.
So what did you do with that first show that you didn't like?
We repaired it.
Oh, good. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the history of your career. You started off writing TV news. Who did you write for? What kind of copy did you have to write?
Well, I wrote news shows. I wrote news shows for radio and television. I was a news writer,
mm-hmm.
union news writer.
So were you writing for Ted Baxter types or for network news anchors?
Both. And there was a difference in those days.
How much did the Mary Tyler Moore Show have its genesis in your writing TV news?
Enormous. Yeah. I mean, Lou Grant was modeled after a great news editor who was at CBS, who died in a plane crash. He was modeled after him.
Mm-hmm.
And Ted Baxter was modeled after people that I hadn't worked with, but people we did some research that we had witnessed. And enormous.
And what about the Mary character?
Mary, we just looked for the woman she'd be and put her in that environment. I mean, the first show had her joining that environment. She wasn't part of it until the first show.
Mm-hmm. No, the Mary Tyler Moore Show really broke a lot of new ground. It was a series about an independent woman who's single. Most of the series took place at work as opposed to at home. She had an interesting job. Did you think of this as breaking new ground, or did you just come up with that idea?
The great thing is that the feminist movement started, like, you know, 8 minutes after the show started. It was just this, so that we were able to draw on it for passion and for story material. That was, you know, so it is that thing of we had the right show at exactly the right time.
My guest is James Brooks. He wrote and directed the new movie, I'll Do Anything, which opens tomorrow. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with James Brooks. Is there, like, common wisdom about how many laughs per 5 minutes there needs to be in a good sitcom? Do you subscribe to any of that?
I think you have to have a laugh just before your sweat gland starts sending a message to you. I don't know what it is on a clock.
Okay.
But, there, you know, it depends on the scene. You have to trust a scene. I mean, you know, sometimes you have to know when to not do a laugh. There was a very key line in the movie that I just finished, very key line, perhaps the most important line in the movie, that got a wonderful laugh. And the play sort of exploded with it because I had her express something, the six-year-old child express something in absolute child's jargon. And it was so delightful that the audience just erupted into laughter. But it followed the most emotional moment in the picture. And it's real tough to take out a laugh that big. And I finally did and put in a line that left only the emotion. Every once in a while, you have to do that, too.
Did it hurt to do that?
Yeah, but I think it was the right thing to do. It was a very tough choice. It was as tough as anything.
Did you grow up watching a lot of family sitcoms?
No, not a lot. I mean, we were not to go for sympathy, but we were quite poor, and it was a long time before we could afford a set.
How old were you when you got it?
I think I was like 14 or something like that.
Well, that's pretty old.
Yeah.
So what was on then?
What shows did I like? Well, Lucy was like amazing. You know, I mean, I remember loving that. But I think the first show that I went And, you know, and this is after I think I was able to buy myself a set then. But the show that I went absolutely crazy over was the Dick Van Dyke Show. I mean, I just couldn't believe that people could be that witty. And it was and just the fact that it was about doing a television show, that the show was about that, and all these people were having these great times, and these funny people got in a room and were friends with each other. I just went nuts over it. Everybody did.
So Dick Van Dyke was really one of the first shows you watched.
I don't know whether it was one of the first shows I watched. Like an experience you can have with a book where it becomes part of your life, where it's so special to you. I had that kind of experience with the Dick Van Dyke Show.
Did that have anything to do with you working with Mary Tyler Moore later?
Well, it meant that I went crazy when I got the chance.
Did you write it for her?
Yes. Myself and Alan Burns.
One of the themes in both Broadcast News and in your new movie, I'll Do Anything, is like how much of your life you devote to you obsessively devote to work, and how much of your life you kind of devote to relationships, to people, to family and friends. Has this been a big issue for you?
Well, obsessive is such an editorial word. I think it's an issue to all of us. I think it's an issue to all of us. And I think we've got to be careful with how we editorialize, because my work sometimes assumes an extraordinary importance to me. And obviously, the key relationships in my life are extraordinarily important to me, obviously. But I should be able to say obviously about my work is, I don't think there's a shame in caring about your work. I don't think there's anything wrong with experiencing like it's life or death. I think if you think you're larger than your work, there's something wrong with it. I think if you're not humbled by your work, something can get wrong with it. You know, if you get inflated by it in a certain way and distorted by your work, there's something wrong with it. But if you really respect what you're trying to do, forget how good you are at it or anything like that, if you respect what you're trying to do and try and do it as well as you know how and feel humbled by it, it's legitimate.
I wasn't trying to say you shouldn't be working hard in this.
You weren't just telling me off? That's my imagination?
I was absolutely not. I was just wondering if it's been a big issue for you.
It's a big issue, who is it a big issue for? There's this girl, Kathy, in the movie, mm-hmm. and I had a 29-year-old entertainment television broadcaster come to interview me. And, you know, I guess you have to see the movie to appreciate this, but it took some courage for her to say, I don't care, I'm Kathy. You know, and you're right. There's a line in the movie. I'll be damned if I apologize for thinking my work is important. I don't have a mate. I don't have a kid. I don't have a talent. I got this, and I'll be damned if I apologize for thinking it's important. Great. Very legitimate. I got what she was saying. I loved her for saying it. And now I met this really bright guy, about 35. I should fix him up, as a matter of fact. I met this really bright guy who's a syndicated columnist, and his questions were really intelligent. You could tell he was quiet and intelligent. And at the end of the interview, he says, I married a Kathy, and we're getting divorced now. And she bought the town just like the girl in your movie did. And in this group of weeks since I finished my movie, I'm so happy that I heard both those comments, you know, because to me, Kathy, as much as any character in it, represents Hollywood and all its confusions and everything else.
What's good and what's bad about it.
Yeah, and I'm glad I heard both those comments.
Yeah. Can I make an observation that you probably won't want to hear?
Well, I'd rather you didn't.
Yeah, right. That's right. Setting myself up for that, aren't I? Yes, and I'll say I'll make it anyways. On some level, I think that maybe your television work has been like more innovative, taken more chances than your movies. Do you know? Which isn't to say that your movies aren't good, but just that they're not trying new things in the way that some of the TV shows have.
Well, I did do that old hat comedy about cancer, and then I did that natural one about whether morality is falling apart. Listen, it's okay. I don't experience it that way. To me, every movie is an enormous chance, and television, because I'm more familiar with it, feels safer. It took a long time to get my first movie made because everybody thought it was an impossible thing to do a movie about.
In terms of endearment.
And this tends to sound self-serving, and I hope it's not. Maybe it is a little in response to your question. But the second one is you know, everybody was telling me that it was too inside. You know, you keep on hearing too inside on Broadcast News. But I know how I got to Broadcast News, and I know how I got to Terms of Endearment, and I know how I got to the one that I did now. And those are the ways that I want to get to everything I do for the rest of my life, if I can. I hope I do. I just know in the first case there was a book where I had an emotional reaction to it that I could not deny. In the second instance, I know I was confused about fundamental changes taking place all around me, and I tried to find an avenue to write write about it and explore it. And I know in the third place, I wanted to take on myself and all these issues of parenthood and working in a confusing town for that I'm drawn to and that I worry about for the last 20 years. So these are as good a reason as I'll ever come up with for doing a piece of work, and I hope the reasons stay that good. Mm-hmm. I mean it.
Right. Okay.
Okay. So watch out.
Yeah. I'm watching. gosh, I'm at a loss for words.
Why don't you knock the way I work again if you're looking for something to say?
You know what I want to wonder again? Like when you're at a screening and the audience isn't laughing at something that you think is really funny, do you ever want to get up there and say, look, don't you get this? Are you not sophisticated enough to get this joke? I mean, I'm just trying to project myself in the situation of somebody who's made a movie and the audience isn't responding in the proper way. I think I'd really want to get up there and just...
Boy, good for you. I want, you know, when that happens, I want to die at that moment, you know, and I think correctly that it is my fault. There's this great lesson that I learned. There's these moments that you recognize as I'm glad this moment happened to me because there's this tremendous lesson in it.
Right. It hurt, but I'll learn something.
Well, this one didn't hurt. It happened to somebody else, but I was there. Ha, ha, ha. So we were going for, you know, on the television shows, you're always working on jokes right up until airtime.
Yeah.
And we had this one key joke that we were standing around looking for the answer to, and it was a blackout joke. A blackout meaning it's more important because it's the last joke in a scene. The scene ends on that. You better get a laugh, or else you're really going to feel bad. I mean, that becomes the most important joke. So we're looking for this blackout, and somebody in the group said, "How about this joke?" and said the joke, and nobody said anything. It was somebody in authority too, and he said, "Well, I think it's funny," and said it again, and then we're still looking for a line. And then he said that same joke, and he said, "Why won't that work?" And somebody said to him, "You know when it's working because everybody walks away, you know, and the job's done." And I think that's real true.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Good talking to you, Terry. It was really interesting.
James Brooks wrote and directed the new comedy I'll Do Anything. It opens tomorrow. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.